know what? Maybe Linux was a mistake.
Well, howdy, folks. It's Friday, and we are drunk and retired.
Actually, we've been recording this whole time.
Huh? So, I mean, JJ's always recording.
Yeah, the only way I can remember anything.
Yeah, I was going to say. You're like, this is a feature. Like, I don't remember anything anyone says. No, it's good.
So my current Linux beef, since we're outing our Linux beefs, is I got this green screen behind me because Zoom on Linux doesn't support doing virtual green screen.
Mm-hmm.
But my camera randomly changes the aspect ratio. And so sometimes, like now, almost all of my green screen fits in apart from like the corners there. Other times I end up with like a foot either side of the green screen of my back wall.
Yeah.
I can't figure out like how to change it, or it just randomly.
That happens to me with the Logitech C920, yeah. I think is the model.
C920, yeah.
Yeah, it depends on which application I'm using, whether it tries to bump it up to HD or keep it at SD. So chicken wings, I'm so happy to say that, Paul, you're with your guidance and enough Googling based on random words you told me, I was able to make 64 absolutely gorgeous chicken wings in the order.
64?
Yeah, I made 64 and nice. Then another 60 veggie solid nuggets. Yeah, so we had 124 meat or meat-like objects in order to have a surprise Hot Ones-themed birthday party on the back porch for a buddy of mine who we wanted to show some love to. And it was really fun. But one of my friends is dairy-free, so I made her some wings without the dairy powder on it. And to see the contrast between adding dairy powder to a chicken wing before I just did convection bake, doing that compared to dairy powder and the baking powder, it was just night and day in the coloring and the crispness of it. So it was really fun.
So why don't you actually talk through the process? Because you're saying dairy powder, sure, but people don't know what you mean.
Fantastic point. I would never have known this if I didn't text you. But
Oh man, I feel left out.
We all have that thread.
You're welcome to text me as well.
We all have that thread with friends where we're not on it.
Yeah.
But so I wanted to do all these chicken wings. I found that in most cases with meat, dry brining has been fantastic. So the idea, especially with chicken wings with the skin on it, like leaving them out overnight, uncovered in a fridge with some seasoning on them, tends to lead to them being ready to, like, much crispier when I cook them. Paul, you can maybe go into the why of that, but that was the first step. That's what I was intending to do.
Yeah, let me interject with the why of that, and then we'll move on to the next bits. So when you dry brine something in the fridge uncovered, what happens? And when you say dry brine, all you need is salt, right? You don't really need anything else. You basically coat the outside in salt. If it's a thicker thing, it's hard to oversalt at that point. If it's something pretty thin, like you'd probably oversalt a chicken wing. But if it's like a whole chicken or like a thick steak, you don't really need to worry about oversalting it. But you salt it, and then you put it like on an oven tray with a rack in the fridge so air can kind of circulate all the way around it. And what happens is salt pulls moisture out, and then the inverse happens and the moisture pulls the salt back into the meat through osmosis,
the diffusion of water across the cell membrane.
At the same time, because of the air circulating around the fridge, it's also drying out the surface. So by the time most of that interchange of liquid to the outside and then pulled back in has happened, you've also got the fridge just kind of air drying it as well. So when it comes time to cooking, you've got meat that's seasoned all the way through and you've got a nice dry surface, which then helps you with the Maillard reaction, which is what causes the browning of the meat. Because it's actually the heat and sugars and protein having a reaction that causes the Maillard reaction, which is different to caramelization, which I think we already talked about.
We did. Oddly enough, we have dug into this more than you'd think for this, yeah, for any podcast.
Right?
But it's so
in cool. order to have that happen, you need to get rid of the surface moisture, because while there's surface moisture, the surface of the meat will never go above boiling, water boiling temperature.
Right.
Right. Just because of the properties of water and turning into vapor and all that, like thermodynamic stuff we don't need to talk about.
So I'll jump back in and say, so I took out chicken wings, dried them off, rolled them in some, not too much salt, a little bit of salt, and then all of them got a little bit of baking powder, because the baking powder, my understanding is it will increase the surface area of the chicken wing by bubbling on the skin. Anyway, Paul will fix that.
There's two things that happen, and I should have looked it up before we started talking, because I don't remember them exactly off the top of my head. One of them is the reaction with the baking powder causing mini air bubbles almost inside the skin, like inside the cells, which then, as you said, creates little bumps, which gives more surface area. But there's also a reaction because it's, I think baking powder is acidic. Mm. And then, so there's a reaction between it and the proteins that then make it easier for them to brown later. So you're kind of getting that double effect.
I had no idea. Okay. Neat. So, you know, basically did that. But then also at Paul's recommendation, I included dairy powder. So putting dairy powder on the chicken wings.
So fat-free skim milk powder.
Right. Exactly.
Specifically. Yeah.
Specifically. And, you know.
So white stuff? If it's dairy, just, if it's skim milk, isn't that the joke? The skim milk is just white water? No.
I think that's pretty fair. I'm yes, mostly lactose intolerant. I don't hang with any of that crap. But
skim milk powder is basically the proteins from milk with no liquid or fat or anything else.
Cool.
And now what we just talked about, both the Maillard reaction and the baking powder effect, changes the properties of the protein and makes the Maillard reaction and makes it brown better. And so you're effectively adding extra protein, which is then allowing for extra Maillard reaction, extra crispiness.
Oh.
So that's why the fat-free milk powder works. You can also use buttermilk powder, I have used in the past, which is effectively the same thing. I haven't really noticed any difference in taste because you're not really using a ton of it, but pretty much any milk powder you're going to get is going to be fat-free, because otherwise it's not going to be powdery. So you can use any kind of milk powder you have. Sometimes you will want to quickly spin it through like a spice grinder or something, because it can be quite thick and clumpy, whereas you want it to be a really smooth powder.
Very cool. Well, the results were freaking great. And they were a great vessel for the spiciest hot sauces I've ever had in my life. It was fun, man.
So before you move on, so salt, baking powder, milk powder, and then in the fridge for like overnight, 12 to 24 hours.
Exactly. Yep.
And then what?
Baked on a convection. So put it in the convection oven at 450 on parchment paper, and then a little bit of peanut oil and a little sprinkle of salt and pepper on each one. And they're perfect. Just gorgeous, tasty. Could have crushed all of them myself, but I shared.
Nice.
Yeah, JJ, have you ever messed around with making chicken wings?
I had the for my wife's birthday, we bought a Foodie Ninja, I think it's called. Which is like a convection oven, air fryer. Yeah, exactly. And we've done air frying of the winglets. And from what y'all have described, I think I'm going to steal some of those ideas to try to do that with the winglets too. Because what we do is we get all the winglets. I put a tablespoon of flour in, tablespoon of lemon pepper, and a tablespoon of habanero, like ground up habaneros. It's the same stuff we use for that bacon we made, Caesar. Yeah. So basically, I haven't used for anything else, so I just threw that in there. And I just shake it up in a bag, and I let it sit for about 30 minutes. And then I put it in the air fryer part of the foodie at 400 for 25 minutes. Now, the reason why I'm saying these things is because turns out it smokes up my whole house. Like, it just burns like crazy. Because I guess maybe the oil I'm using, which is canola oil, like, it gets to the point where, like, you can look and see the smoke in my house where the light shines through the window or whatever. Good. Yeah. So I feel like I'm doing something wrong, but.
Yeah. You said 400, right?
Yeah.
So I think a canola oil smoke point is above 400.
That's what I thought so too.
Well, maybe it's right at 400. Okay. Yeah.
The internet tells me it's right at 400.
It could also be the flour burning.
You know, that probably is it, because it does, like, it does blacken, but it chars it in the way that it makes it crunchy, which is what we want. We want our wings to be crunchy, like the skin on the wings, the winglets, to get kind of crunchy. So then when we put the hot sauce on it, it's kind of like this, it's I can't remember about to use these terms. Mm-hmm. The mouth feel is right. So
it's like crunchy. The mouthfeel is crunchy, then through to moist.
Yeah, well, a little bit gooey and a little bit salty too, but you know.
All right.
There you go. But yeah, no, so long story short, Broberg, yes, absolutely. I've gone down this. I've attempted to do it myself at a much smaller scale, of course, compared to what you were saying.
Yeah, sure. I mean, that sounds delicious though. And I how to double check that I knew what a winglet was. Like, that's the separation of the two pieces of a chicken wing.
Yep.
Okay. That was for the first time I could only find, at a butcher, like the full wing or I bought like a bunch that were full wing. I'm like, oh crap, what am I going to do with this? And I just Googled until I found a couple of videos and cut them apart for the first time,
nice.
Which is pretty damn straightforward process. You just kind of like,
yeah,
you know, line it up in the, you know, the joint between each end. You pop off the little nubbin and separate the two. So it was kind of cathartic almost, and felt more. Yeah, I guess, and it's a hell of a lot cheaper. I guess the pre-cut ones.
Significantly cheaper, it's like to the point where it's crazy. Though I do want to say, I do want to throw out a tidbit of trivia and or fat guy admitting thing here. Myself, I don't like the drumlets. I like the ones with the two little bones inside of it, which I guess is the actual wing, not the drumlets, right? Most people go for the drumlets because they're noobs, right? And whatever, go, you have those, that's fine. What you want is actual wings, because it's, hopefully I can find a little animated GIF or this or something that I can put in the show notes, but there's a secret way to eat them, or at least a known way to eat them that I only recently learned. You take the winglet, you twist it, and you pull out one of those bones from it. So then all of a sudden you have all the meat and skin on one of the bigger bone that you can just take and just suck off all the meat. And it comes off in one big thing. It is, as soon as you learn how to
do that motion one more time.
No, I will not do that motion one more time.
All right.
But as soon as you get that.
Folks at home, you're not seeing the video here, but I think you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. As soon as you get that down, you never want to eat chicken wings any other way. Just saying. It's this little twist, rip, suck, and it's amazing. Just saying.
Twist, rip, suck, huh?
Yep. Just like tequila, right? Or something? No, wait, that's lick, suck, shoot? No, shoot. I don't know. I'm a Texan. I just drink my tequila.
You're a bear?
Yeah, I just drink my tequila straight anyway, so it doesn't bother me. Anyway, sorry, rambling on.
No, it's fantastic. So, chicken wings. So
what did you do with the ends, Matt? What did you do with the ends?
Oh, like the little things that look like little fingers?
Yeah.
Nothing. I didn't know what to do with it.
Oh. You could have made a broth. You can make a chicken stock. Yeah, just throw it into
a pan.
The thing, the slow cooker. The slow cooker. Throw it into the slow cooker and just let it like
No.
Just
blitz it. Just boil the shit out of it. Nobody's got time for slow cookers.
Makes your house smell.
So what you could do is roast them alongside the other wings and mm-hmm. then stick them in a pan, cover it with water, and then boil the shit out of them for a couple of hours. And you'll get like a really tasty stock that you can then turn into like a gravy or something like that.
Huh. Yeah. One step at a time.
Right.
Speaking of taking another step into something that you may or may not want to, I hear there's a resurgence of self-hosting of applications.
Well, JG, really? Are we running a Mavis D, PostFix, and Clam AV now at home again? Spam Assassin?
Yeah, exactly. No, well, okay, so that might have sounded a little, that might have sounded a little, formulaic. I guess is a good statement because we're moving. Anyway, point being, so maybe I'm just paying more attention to it now. But if you go, I started noticing through different channels that I'm on that people are looking to self-host different applications that they traditionally would have used, like a Google app or a third-party company to do it. Like one of the most common examples I see is Slack. Right, people you would use Slack, but there's now this small resurgence of people using something called Mattermost, right? Because it's a way to basically host your own Slack version behind your own firewall, so you don't have to pay Slack for X, Y, and Z. It also goes into the conversation of knowledge bases and all the different ways to do knowledge bases, like MediaWiki or Bookstack or things like that. Maybe I'm just more sensitive to it now. But
no, JJ, I'm with you there, man. I think I'm coming at it probably from a different angle. There's a lot of, I think people are more aware than ever of the privacy that they are giving up by using SaaS products.
Exactly, yeah.
And I think we all for a while were super pumped that we didn't have to pay for anything on the internet and like we got great services for free. But I don't know if it's a function of age or the 2020s or whatever. But there's a recognition that if you're not paying for a product, you are the product. Mm-hmm. And I am mm-hmm. certainly at an age where I'm trying to consume products, not be consumed anymore. Yep. So I'm definitely looking at more self-hosting and being at, on opensource.com, a really popular topic lately is Nextcloud as a replacement for all of Google Suite. It's really quite incredible and self-hosted.
Well, before we go any farther, just because I want to make sure that hopefully somebody's listening to this podcast. Hi, if you're listening. TLDR, what's the difference between OwnCloud and NextCloud? Because I've heard them as synonyms. I know that they're different things, but I'd like from as someone who has been sitting in that world for a little while now, what is the actual difference?
We need a practicer of the freedoms.
Exactly.
To explain this to us.
Exactly.
So I have not heard of OwnCloud, to be honest.
Oh.
So I'm going to guess that they are two separate implementations of something.
No. Okay. No. I guess I got this one then.
Oh, it's a short question. That. Cool. Yep. Go for it, JJ. Back so, to you.
Yeah, right. So OwnCloud was the original project. And it was, I believe it's based off a French company, if I'm correctly. And they wanted to enterprise it. They wanted to turn it into an enterprise offering that you could run all the stuff behind in your firewall and then make money off of it. They agreed that they needed an open source fork to keep the community going. So they forked OwnCloud from OwnCloud to NextCloud and let NextCloud kind of have a life of its own. So you can get a enterprise supported OwnCloud instance, which is the root of NextCloud. But NextCloud was so successful in the community that it actually took a life of its own and has some amazing plugins, an amazing world around it. It's basically, to your point earlier, it's Google Drive on your own hardware. Okay, not 100%, but very, very, very close to that. And people literally spend like their whole world inside of that. I know for a fact, OwnCloud, the Enterprise Edition, NetGate, the people who make pfSense, use that as their way to distribute their images for pfSense routers, which I thought was really interesting. They don't use S3, they don't use anything like that. They actually send you an OwnCloud link where you pull down the IMG. Not that I had to do this recently or anything, but it was just an interesting kind of, oh, they wanted to make sure they have control over their information on their own software, which I thought was interesting.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Paul, are you self-posting anything that you either are excited about or wish you weren't?
Only the illegal things I do.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. We'll just move right along then.
Well, so I would like to ask this to y'all, because I've struggled with this throughout my whole career and my whole like adult life, I guess, is knowledge management. I've been zeroing in on knowledge management recently, and it kind of goes hands in hand with self-hosting, because there's so many options to do knowledge management inside of it. Broberg, do you run your own wiki? Do you use something to do that? How do you do your knowledge management of all the stuff you need to take care of? And if you say OneNote,
another Evernote.
Evernote. That's right. Not Evernote lecture.
Okay, yeah, piss off, Paul. So, in a nutshell, I don't care about the specific tool. I'll say like, there are two distinct tasks that I think are really important to separate, and one is like your to-do list, like things that are actionable, probably get things done oriented structure of like projects that you're working on. And then there's your scratch pad, which needs to be flexible to be visualized in however ways work for you. So I like to draw some ideas out. I like to write a lot. I like to use Kanban style cards when I can to think through things. At least today, the way I separate things, I have Evernote for the scratch pad, and I tend to like draw stuff. I'll upload images. I have a self-made Kanban on my wall to my right, since no one leaves home anyway, so I might as well make it physical. I use get things done style, like weekly and daily reviews that I post in Evernote for myself. But then all my tasks are in Todoist, which has a fantastic API.
It has that thing.
Markdown compatibility, integrates with your calendar. It works unless you're a dummy. Sorry, JJ.
No, I couldn't get into it. I just couldn't.
No, I've gone through so many, I have no higher ground to stand on here. It's worked for me for the longest of any app, like 3 years now. But I was looking at self-hosting with Standard Notes, which is an open source pluggable note alternative that you can directly import Evernote from. Yeah, it's Standard really, Notes. Really cool. Yeah, standardnotes.org. And I really wanted to because it's native to Linux. They have a great native setup. They have like
you can use org mode with Emacs.
Oh God, I didn't know I was talking to an Emacs there. Jesus. not my hill to die on. There are other ones I prefer. So anyway, like they have like a knowledge base type plugin for it. It's really pretty cool. The key feature it's missing for me at the moment is they don't have any native universal shortcut keys. And like I only use tools that give me shortcuts. I think that's 90% of how I navigate my computer is not pointing and clicking. So that would drive me nuts. But yeah, so in a nutshell, that's like those are my tool chains.
CZ, how about you?
I am really bad at all of that stuff. I make aborted attempts a couple of times a year. I have a long trail of wikis and notes apps and other stuff behind me as I've attempted to use stuff and just never been able to stick.
Okay.
So at this point, I'm definitely at the zero knowledge base in my house. If it's not in my head, it doesn't exist. And very little sticks in my head.
Unless it has to do with chicken wings.
Yeah, right. Well, so if you don't mind, I'd like to dig into that a little bit deeper, because that's another problem, right, that I've seen myself run into, where I look at all the options of ways of trying to do this stuff, and I get choice paralysis, or to the point where it's like, do I really want to break what, like, I've been functional as a human for this long. Do I need to spend the time and effort to reorganize this stuff? Like, is there a real benefit to me to learn something new, to organize my knowledge base? I'm using the term knowledge base very loosely here, because arguably you could create something like a book stack where you just have recipes in it, right? Compared to a to-do list of a wiki that has all of your to-dos or whatever. Like, it's a much larger conversation. And I know that personally, I struggle with it because I can't really see what I need to do. Does that make sense? Or did I lose you? No.
You lost me.
Sounds
a little
like
bit.
JJ, we need to solve this for you. I would suggest you run a TiddlyWiki on a USB stick.
Mm.
And
yeah,
you take it with you everywhere you go.
Definitely.
Do you remember? Was it TiddlyWiki?
It's still around. It's still around. People still use it. Wow. Yeah, they still use it. Yeah.
And I'll also sign up for your bulletin board. That way we can only talk through there. You don't have to have so many channels to manage. Just like drastically simplify your life. Like
PHPBB. I'll have like three or four different forums on PHPBB. And I get anyone who ever wants to talk to me to post something on there, and I respond directly to that.
Think about all the free time you'll have by not having friends anymore.
Right? I think you're supposed to use Discourse now, not PHPBB.
Yeah.
Not to be confused with Discord, which you're supposed to use instead of Slack, or in addition to Slack, while also connecting to Discourse, which I constantly use the wrong word for.
But isn't Discord still full of Nazis? Or have they fixed that yet?
I thought they got booted from there. I can't quite keep track. They're always hiding in plain sight.
Yeah.
Isn't that just the collective name for white people?
Oh,
keep that to yourself there, buddy. They don't let me in. I'm not their target audience. I just say L'chaim once and everyone's like, wait a minute. to step back into the absolute tragedy that would be trying to get you to adopt a system that you don't choose to adopt yourself, like, could you go on with your life without a tool like that? Absolutely. So like it's always a question of return on investment and like what you want from yourself. Like, do you want to be able to look something up easily that you've come across before? Like, that is really essential to me, that I am willing to put in the additional effort of maintaining that. And if you're not going to do that, it's not going to do it for you. And then, you know, one of the more fascinating parts of procrastination is that you can do research to avoid actually doing anything.
Yeah.
I'm really skillful at it.
Yes.
Like, I probably spent years thinking of which to-do app I was going to do and make to-do tasks in each of them to look into them. And then I'm like, I just need to pick something. So the paradox of choice really lands where, like, you are the paradox, like, and you have to choose. So if you want to, or skip out if you don't. And either way, just be happy with your choice.
I'll say the one thing that has stuck with me for as long as I can remember now, which isn't very long because I have a horrible short-term and long-term memory, hence the reason why I need a knowledge base, is Google Keep, believe it or not.
Oh, yeah.
For whatever reason, Google Keep has landed with me, but I've noticed that it's really badly organized. That's a different conversation. But I do want to just throw this out, and I'll put this in the show notes too, which is Awesome Self-Hosted, where that seems to be the best collection of self-hosted apps for yourself. And there's so many options for different things inside of there that you get that choice paralysis again. And there's this weird snake eating itself problem that I'm identifying, at least myself. And I'm trying to figure out a way to break past it. I will say, I have spun up something called a book stack recently, on bookstackapp.com, I think it is, which is a way to have a wiki, a searchable wiki through everything. And it has Markdown support too, which I thought was kind of nice. And the actual mobile app, you can edit it on from your phone too. Oh, there's not a mobile app, there's a web app, but then you can bring it up and you can actually edit this stuff. And it exports out to PDF really nicely too, with some really cool pictures and all that. So from a man who used to use MetaWiki, the same thing, or MediaWiki, the thing that...
MediaWiki.
The Wikipedia uses. I used to use that pretty religiously. To me, moving to this, I feel like I've skipped like three generations of web technologies, and I'm very, very proud, or very, very impressed by it. So
nice.
Anyway, so that's me rambling on about self-hosted things.
No, that's great. I mean, Paul and I recently got into some unnecessary arguments about technology. So Paul, what's your favorite package manager?
Docker.
I mean,
so that's actually a way better answer than the ones we were using. Did you say Bash? Like,
Bash. Bash is the package manager. Curl is the transport mechanism.
./configure make install, call it a day.
Yeah,
Bash.
That calls ./configure make install and call it a day.
I don't need to know that. That's in the Bash.
Oh, that's implementation details.
I don't need to read it. I don't need to care about it.
How dare you talk about compiling code as if Paul needs to care about that.
Look, all I care about is you have a website that ends in .sh so that I know I can do a curl against it.
That way I trust you. Yes. I trust you because it says sh and that means shell.
Yes.
Means shall. I don't have an H for it anyway.
Shall hurt.
Shall hurt. No, I was getting trolled. I don't know who trolled whom. There's a great GIF by... Oh, wait, how did that start? Who? Totally blanking.
So while you look it up, you made a comment about using Homebrew on Linux. And that then brought some discussion. I made some jokes about curl bash.
No. No.
And then I said jokes about curl bash.
No. Using Homebrew on Linux is a horrible idea.
I'm going to fight you so hard. Okay. So it came back. So Corey Quinn made a beautiful GIF of him spitting out coffee. And the quote was, the recommended approach for installing the AWS Cloud SAM CLI on Linux is to use the Homebrew package manager. And in response, he has a great GIF of him spitting out that we will link to. And my response is Homebrew is a goddamn gift to the Linux user or to Linux users. I'll be on the hill if you want to join me and presumably die there with me. And Paul jumped in. He's like, you're on a bad hill and you should feel bad. And it's just going to digress from there in a great way.
Right.
But I think
the funny thing was then some folks showed up and took what we were saying quite seriously.
It's always the best. Thank you, internet, for taking jokes that are really hurting. These ones truly hurt no one except ourselves. So I don't feel any guilt about it. But I am serious. So, you know, I've documented on this podcast and on opensource.com that I've transitioned to Linux as my main OS. And I'm swapping between, a Debian, derived Linux distro using apps to install. And then I use my Fedora laptop for work. So DNF as the installer. And I freaking hate it, man. Like I don't have a shared config across the two. And every time I run either of those commands, it's just an infinite scroll of junk being updated. And when I say junk, it's like to the point of Paul's joke is also there's some seriousness. Like there are times when I want to hide some implementation details and get to the point. And Homebrew is perfect at hiding the right level of details in the right context. And then you can just run a brew info and get all the nerd knobs and customize to no end where you're compiling from and downloading to. And so I use a single brew file and that I update that through my dot files. and then I get the exact same install of all my command line utilities across all three of my operating systems with very little config. And if you can tell me how to do that with any of the crap you use, I'm happy to do it.
I'm going to step in and say that I think there are two types of package management. There is your system package management and your user space package management. And Linux hasn't been good at solving user space package management, hence curl bash, right? So no one installs Apache by doing curl bash. No one installs like Python itself with curl bash, right? You use your system packages. But if you want to like install like random CLI, like the Docker CLI or kubectl or like YQ or JQ or any of that, there's no good way to install those things as a user, right? If you're lucky, they're in your system packages. If you're unlucky, you're finding like a PPA or something or whatever equivalent your OS has, and you're having to sudo that shit. For stuff that can just be in like your own local like home directory slash bin. So I think if you're focusing on homebrew as something that is taking care of that
purely like the user space.
End of user space, I think it's, I have no problem with it whatsoever. If it's going to wrap around things like virtualenv, if it's going to wrap around like rbenv and all that garbage and just give you a unified way to like install a random thing that's just for you, go for it.
What I'm hearing, it's a unified abstraction layer for Broberg to move back and forth between what was a Mac, Fedora, and Debian, or Red Hat, or RPM and Debian based OSs.
Pop OS and Fedora and Mac OS. I use the same brew file and I have the same command line utilities and same command line interface. And that's meaningful to me. Yeah.
So let me tell you about sudo chef dash client. So we can write a cookbook.
Tell me more.
No.
But in all legitimacy, I know this isn't the whole argument. Like there are a ton of package managers. I have been like told I'm crazy to use a non-standard one. So JJ, like go back to your initial response where you're just like, this is a stupid idea. Like I want to hear that argument too.
So I understand after fleshing out the argument a little bit better, I understand your vantage point of as an end user, you wanted one brew file that you know you had the same toolbox that goes back and forth between the different machines you have to touch. Totally respect that. The problem is that the level that homebrew can do, it starts encroaching in actual system administration. And it is not designed for that. And that's where, as a sysadmin, DevOps, whatever you want to call it, engineer, that I still have that. I still wear that hat because I feel like I'm still at least tied to that industry.
That identity. Ecosystem. It's an identifier for you.
Exactly, yeah. Homebrew abstracts too much away to the point where you are relying on third party management of that abstraction to get the software on your machine. So just to CZ's point of installing Apache, right? You would never use homebrew to install Apache on a production machine. The problem is though, because as an end user, Broberg, one day you get promoted to be a systems engineer and random company and you get the point. You take that human who was just using homebrew as their abstraction, it's possible eventually they could get to that level where they need to install Apache. And they've only ever used homebrew to do it because of the abstractions, because it's made life convenient for them, not realizing that there's a line there. And unfortunately, I've seen enough in my career where someone who has gotten really used to using something some way or do something some way. Perfect example, showing my age here, using Capistrano as a deployment mechanism for an application and system administration was a really bad idea. But developers knew how to use Capistrano to get their application out, so why not we use it also to install some packages, right? And then that's when the conversation, for at least for me, Chef came in to do all that work for him. I'm just worried go ahead.
I think some rebuttal to that is you're talking about a systemic problem, not a people problem. Like, it's a systemic problem in your organization if it's okay for someone to brew install Apache on a production server. Right, that tells me you have a stink in your company and the way your company does things. Because that should not be...
Yeah, no, you're right. You are absolutely right there. Yes.
I think there's legitimacy to saying there's a comfort level, and the implication there for me though, JJ, is that people should be using Linux as on the desktop so that they're practicing to be system administrators. And that's the connection that I disagree. I don't need to give a shit about that career path. I wanted to use Linux because I wanted to use Linux. And if I don't have to learn the quote unquote right way to do it as a sysadmin, I don't have to worry about the slippery slope argument of when I do get promoted into this career path, I'm going to fuck it up. Go for it.
Yeah, no. So I apologize that my point is there, but the challenge is that there's or at least from what I believe as a Linux user, especially as just a consumer, right? We're going to go back to the old argument with OpenStack real quick. Bear with me. So people just said, hey, just deploy OpenStack and you can run it, or you can develop against it and do whatever you need to get done. Not realizing that there was actually three different communities of people out there: consumers of OpenStack, people who ran OpenStack clouds, and people who developed it. And I genuinely believe there's a mirror there for Linux users, right? Where there's people who just want to consume Linux, there are people who want to run Linux servers, and then there are people who want to develop against it, right? It's three very clear paths. Now, for me personally, I genuinely believe curiosity for someone who wants to consume Linux, as a consumer, you eventually start seeing where all the knobs and dials are inside of the Linux ecosystem, and you become more and more to the point where you want to run things inside of it. You start seeing that, it's not like a Mac or Windows for that matter, where there's so many guardrails that you have to spend the effort to get there. I genuinely think the human psyche, because the engine or the hood is off the car, you start looking in it and start seeing the different things that's there that you can start manipulating. And then all of a sudden, if you have those abstractions, you have bad habits that you have to break to understand why those things are gone. So there's more cognitive overhead to be able to get to that point where you should just be using DNF instead of homebrew. Does that make sense?
I think, JJ, you're falling under a fallacy of everyone is like you.
Well, yeah, everyone is like me, aren't they?
I'm sure there's plenty of folks out there that are using Linux that do not care and will not ever care about the underpinnings of Linux. So you look at things that do run on Linux, there are some pretty heavy video editing tools like DaVinci Resolve that runs on Linux. Are reasons that someone might choose to run that on Linux.
Blender.
Right? And those people that are editing videos and doing super high-end sound manipulation or I don't know, whatever it is they do, colorizing film and stuff, they're not ever going to want to care about the underpinnings of Linux. They're using it specifically because it's free and they can run their free Resolve on top of it and get the equivalent powerhouse of a $1 million video production system on a $1,000 machine with no extra spend.
So I'm gonna
like that person should never have to care about the underpinnings of Linux.
And I'm gonna land somewhere between your two, which is I don't think you should have to care all the time in all contexts exactly what's going on. There are times where somebody might care and they're gonna wanna dig back and they're gonna wanna see exactly how is this path configured, how are these files compiled, what is in this proc directory. And it's super fun that you can poke around and learn and you can install tools to help you explore further. But I shouldn't have to care all the time. Like there are times when I just wanna get a task done. And I think one of the things that's really held back the adoption of Linux is this assumption that the only people that should use it are the ones that are all in all the time. Like there are sometimes I'm thinking like a Mac user. I just like love that this thing just gets me and it gets stuff done and it's kind of pretty. And then other times I'm super thankful that I can just hack the hell out of it and do something weird I'd never be allowed to in another operating system. I think we do operate in multiple modes and we're certainly not all the same person, but I'm noticing a lot of people reading the stuff that I'm writing on opensource.com that is more in like the, I just want this stuff to work a little bit and have some fun doing it and play around with more open source. And maybe I'll learn but when I want to, not like when I'm trying to get this video to load and I have to figure out what codecs to install through what package of some craft through DNF, which was a real first experience I had and almost threw out my Linux-based laptop. So it's
so let me ask a quick question. JJ, you've got a new Fedora machine. You need to install kubectl and JQ. What is the correct way to do it?
Docker run, Docker run a container that I have those things already built inside of it, and I just go from there.
How do you install Docker?
Is that what you do?
Well, Right. Well, no. The idea is that if I have a new machine that I knew was going to be quote unquote clean, I have been making conscious effort to build Docker containers for my tooling, and I have a IBM cloud Docker container that I can pull down that has all the tooling inside it that I need to be able to run against it. But if I can't run Docker immediately on it, or Podman for that matter, because got to throw one out to my Red Hat brother in here. Normally I just, if I know I have some tooling that I've got to go onto it, I just go to the website and I do the curl to pull down the binary and then put it in my bin directory. That's what I normally do. And I do it by hand.
Oh, bash.
I do. Because it's how I know how to get those tooling. Because, it's all Go binaries, right? And that's
Matt, you've got a new Fedora machine. You have to install two things, kubectl and JQ. What do you do?
Curl pipe, bash, homebrew, then brew install. And the additional reason why I do that is I don't want to be responsible for remembering to look up do each of these tools auto update, or do I have to go pull down new binaries once in a while? Like, how am I keeping track of that? Like that whole thing of, security is like all these random tools being out of date that I don't actually manage very well. And Homebrew manages that for me.
Let me just finish my question. Is Homebrew big enough and does it have a big enough user base, and are the things open enough that in general it's going to be pretty safe to do a brew install JQ or brew install random fairly legitimate binary or application and be pretty safe that no one's put a backdoor in it? As much so as like a apt PPA or something.
Yes,
like,
it is.
That's a pretty fair assumption to say that, right?
The brew files. Is it called recipe files? What are they called?
Brew files, they call them, it's formula or recipes.
Formula, yeah. That's right. The formula files are SHA attached or 256 shum attached to Git branches. If you got to do like it is really like it's back to the old style BSD ports trees. Like it's really close to a ports tree. If you actually look at what ports used to do for BSD and what Homebrew does, they're very, very close. But my concern with this whole thing is that it's a third party abstraction. But I do want to say,
Hang on. I'm going to stop you right there. So when you use Docker to run kubectl and jq, is that not a third party abstraction?
No, I build a Docker containers myself.
And is that something that you're going to be doing in production?
Well, I'm a developer advocate. I don't do anything in production. Zing. No,
like I work in fucking marketing and you wanted me to be a sysadmin an hour ago.
all the arguments you made to Matt just before, I feel all apply equally to your answer of using Docker.
Yeah.
We're all abstracting things to make life better. Ta-da. Yeah. Paul rests his case. You will pay for the cost of him as my representative. The end. That was really fun. Thanks for entertaining the discussion, JJ. Like it's I think that there are really interesting technical details to get into. I have a coworker who's all about app images as like the right way to do package managing, which is pretty brilliant that it's all self-contained and you just give it executable and then boom, you've got an application.
There was one thing I did want to mention.
Flatpacky kind of thing?
That's the one thing I wanted to bring up about the keeping things up to date. The Flatpak or snaps, they actually have a callback to the mothership 4 times a day to see if it's out of date or not. If you actually look at the specs inside of it, so if there's a new version that comes out at some point during the day, it'll actually reinstall itself and update it to that point. So arguably snaps are a little bit more quote unquote secure because it's calling back constantly looking for the next version that comes out of the application. So I thought that was
more secure than what?
Like using something like Homebrew or DNF in that case, right?
Homebrew updates every time you...
It constantly pings back. Yeah, it constantly calls back. Asking you like, am I out of date? Is there a new version? Do I need to update? And you attach yourself to channels, kind of like what Habitat does, where you're like, do I want to do bleeding edge? Do I want to do stable? Do I want to do whatever? But by default, I think it goes against stable, but you can pop. Anyway, I'm not 100% sure there, but I thought that was really interesting because it really does call back to the mothership every 4 times, 5 times a day, which was I feel like that's a security problem. And I feel like in the sense that like you can get telemetry off of that, but you have no way of knowing what's sending. I don't know. Anyway, that's a whole nother can of worms.
Totally. Well, yeah, it's package managers are fascinating, but I know we're starting to come to close of an episode and I'd be remiss not to ask you, JJ, you said you had a eureka moment with spreadsheets and I got to hear that story before I go.
Okay. All right. So I've been, as mentioned earlier, I consider myself a system administrator, DevOps engineer, whatever you want to call you. And I use Bash and I do all that stuff. And that's my development level, right? Like I glue shit together. I always looked, for lack of a better term, down on my managers and my other people and my teams that would always do things inside of spreadsheets because I thought, oh, they're doing, like, for lack of a better term, bitch work. It's all businessy stuff, right? Well, like, because I was doing my code or whatever, and I was like, oh, I'll just write a database to do all that. And I never wrote the database to do or used the database to do it, but that's how I thought a spreadsheet was. Well, recently, I've actually had to do some reporting for IBM because what is IBM but more than just reporting up the chain? That's true. Like every big corporation,
TPS reports.
Yeah. Every big corporation has a report. Like you've got to send reports up. So I started getting these requirements, and they're like, I realized very quickly that it was a spreadsheet. They were asking for a spreadsheet. So I went on a little spirit quest as a quote unquote developer, a DevOps engineer, to learn spreadsheets. Turns out, I had a sudden moment of clarity like just straight moment of clarity of saying that this was literally me building a database and it is development work. All spreadsheets is just a different language, a simplified programming language to allow you to build insanely complex information and boil it down to a handful of things. And then slap Google Slides on top of it too, where you can actually not even send the spreadsheet up. You send a bunch of slides up with the different pivot tables of the information you have inside of it, where you can give it to a random executive and be like, this is the information you need. If this is out of date, or just before you do it, hit this little refresh button. Congratulations, you have the most up-to-date information. And this is actually what it is costing you at that moment. It took me a handful of days, but oh my God, I'm like the next kind of, like, it is insane on how much information I can be like, no, it turns out we are costing X, Y, and Z now. You like, it's no longer, oh, it's back of the napkin math. It's like, no, I know down to the dollar how much we're spending. And if you do this, you need to take that cost on saying this, this, and this. And they're like, oh, oh shit, really? Like, yeah.
Nice, JJ, congrats.
So you're talking about costs and savings. So I bet that you can even pull the raw costs from an API and embed them into a cell and then use those as part of the calculation, right?
Have you ever used the IBM cloud, my friend?
I'm not trying to like specifically talk about...
I think that's
against
his terms of service.
But like in general, if there's an API that you can get information out of, you can tie that into the contents of a cell, right?
Yeah.
That's the thing that most spreadsheeting tools let you do, right? Mm-hmm. So that's that's great. Because you're not only getting like a database, but you're also getting something that's querying other data sources. I guess like, is spreadsheets like the OG NoSQL?
It is. Yeah.
No. It's 100% a relational database structure.
You're right.
Me.
Yeah.
I guess you could technically like use it as blobs and not consistently organize your cells, but it's by design supposed to be relational. You can even, I've been using the natural language processing interface, and instead of writing like really terrible array formulas that like mash up all the data and basically command line pipe stuff in there, I've been using like the SQL-like syntax to pull data from a sheet and then like plop it in and filter. It's really quite nice.
So my next challenge with going down this spirit quest of me understanding all of a sudden that this is useful stuff to do, is it just experience, or how do you learn how to organize your data? Like, what I've learned to do through the training that I've gone through, because I had to, right? I had to get someone to teach me this. So I found some training. I have a raw data sheet where I just put down the data of all the information. And then I have a number sheet that tries to like correlate the data to make all that happen, which I try to get the information and the charts and all that bullshit on. How do you get better at that? Because I know looking at it, it's kind of scatterbrained. Like, is there like a theory behind organizing this type of data?
I'm sure there is theory behind it. I'm sure there are plenty of schools and courses where they'll teach you to like spreadsheet good. Mm-hmm. But I think for our type of use cases, I don't think we need to go that deep, right? Because as you've discovered, you can do pretty powerful stuff just by like dumping shit in a sheet and then using another sheet for some formulas and then a third sheet for display or a Google slide for a display.
Yeah, that's true. Right?
And that's really all you need. You need somewhere where all the data ends up, somewhere that is going to do some manipulation of that data, and then somewhere that's going to display that data. I feel like the second two, there's some overlap and you don't necessarily need to have two separate ones of that. But I think as you get more complex, you tend to split them out.
There's some good Python bindings.
You end up with kind of...
Yeah. There's some good Python bindings to Google Spreadsheets too, that you can scrape against things and get them to update it for you. I started doing that because I was like, there's back to the poke about the IBM cloud and the reporting or the costing database or API. I actually did start looking into that just to pull directly from it, so I didn't have to do it because I don't want to keep those numbers up to date, because who knows if that cluster, instead of 50 cents an hour, costs 56 cents an hour or whatever. I don't want to have to go and figure that data out.
But I will give you one cheat in case you need to use this in your spreadsheeting.
Cheat on a sheet? There you go. That's the name of the the podcast. This, by the way, cheat on a sheet.
There you go. Write that down. But if you need to, I put a dash dash in front of either a parenthetical formula or the name of the formula, and you'll typecast it into a number. That way, you can do math on it without breaking. I ran into it's not documented terribly well, but if you put minus minus in front of if you do regex match on some information, it will return a string. So you actually have to do the conversion into an integer in order to continue to do math. And I couldn't figure this out for ages. I had this bug in a spreadsheet that was frustrating me to no end. And I found out you can typecast. So the more you know, and guess what, JJ, the only reason I know that is because I put it into Evernote. So suck on that, Paul.
Nice.
I feel like we've gone full circle with that one.
That's a pretty damn good place to stop. That really is.
Actually, I wanna quickly talk about something real quick. Like, we're all stuck at home. None of us have seen our team members. None of us have had any chance to build camaraderie with our teams. I know people have changed jobs and have never met the people they're working with. In fact, we have Tiffany on our team, has never met any of us, right? So on just a couple of days ago, on Monday, we had a guy come in on Zoom and do a cooking class with us. Mm-hmm. And so it was a guy who goes by the name of Yakitori Guy on YouTube. And you'll never guess, he does yakitori. He had a similar thing. Where he was doing pop-ups and stuff around the Bay Area, actually around the country. And he goes to Japan for 3 months at a time to work in Japan and learn over there as well. And so he's been everything he was trying to do was put on hold by COVID as well. And so he started up a YouTube channel, is doing classes and stuff. Anyway, we did this class with him and it was fantastic. Over the course of 4 hours, we from a whole chicken, broke it down and skewered it up and then cooked it over grills. And he had methods for doing it in the oven, on a gas grill, on a flat top, on your regular thing. So it didn't matter what you had at home, you could cook it. And so it was amazing. It was delicious. So we, I think we made 11 or 12 different skewers from different cuts of chicken.
Really?
Because a chicken isn't that different to a cow. It's just a lot smaller. And so from the thigh, there's four, at the amateur level, there's 3 or 4 different cuts of meat you get out of the thigh to make 3 or 4 different yakitori skewers.
So what's the best way to, level. What's the best way to practice this? Is just buy a chicken and just start cutting away and seeing what you can get out of it? Or is there specific videos that we should watch to kind of teach you?
So Yakitori Guy.
There you go. Okay.
Is exactly what he's been doing. So he started at the, here's a whole chicken, we're going to break it down. And I think he did 4 videos before he even got to cooking anything.
Wow.
And I've been watching them and practicing on them. And so I'd recommended we get him in. But the difference between just trying to repeat something that someone's doing on YouTube versus having them interactively helping you is very different. I mean, we weren't in the same room and he couldn't reach around behind me and guide my knife hand. He could at least I could point the camera at my chicken and he could say, oh, that's what you did wrong. Or, that's a, so it worked out really well.
That sounds fantastic.
For the last 3 or 4 days, I've been eating chicken skewers because a whole chicken goes a long way when you're breaking it down in chicken skewers.
I'm into it, Paul.
So I highly recommend. Doesn't have to be Yakitori Guy, but there's other folks as well. So another place, Black Sesame Kitchen. They're actually based out of Beijing, but the owner was in the US when COVID hit, and so is in the US, and she's been doing classes as well. So like super deep traditional like Chinese cookery.
Oh, wow.
She's been doing Zoom classes as well. So there's tons of stuff out there. I'm sure there's also plenty of like half-assed, not very good ones. But I think like Yakitori Guy, the Black Sesame Kitchen, both are like really, really good.
And before we started doing this podcast, one of my goals over that the Christmas break of 2019 was to learn how to butcher a chicken. You might have re-inspired me to start watching videos on this so I can learn how to do it, because to Broberg's point about the winglets and all, buying an actual chicken is insanely cheaper than buying all the other parts. So this feels like it's a well worth path.
And the good thing is like you start and you practice on your cheap, you know, dollar a pound chicken, right?
Mm-hmm. And then you grow your chickens at home.
Switch to like your $4 like a pound, you know, whole foods like the Mary's chicken or the, you know, the various pasture raised ones. And like you get a major boost to the quality and the taste of the chicken. But you're at the point where you've actually got some practice and you're like making the best out of that more expensive chicken. So I definitely think, you know, start with something cheaper. Especially if you've got no guidance other than trying to watch a YouTube video on YouTube.
How long does it take from
three or four chickens, I reckon.
I was going to say like growing chickens at home. So I have a coop of chickens to the point where I'm killing the chickens and slaughtering them to eat them. Like, what's the turnaround on that? You know, then
depends how young your chickens you want to eat. I mean,
I'm just saying
the best thing about day-old chickens is their snack size.
Hey, there it is.
Oh, wow.
That, I think that's the podcast title right there.
Well, link to the part up to the dead chicken that are adult age, and we'll definitely be down. I'd love to do something like that with my team. So good call, Paul.
Well, do we have anything less to say? Because we've easily hit the hour now, if not longer now. Don't
I thought we were done.
Oh,
I thought we were already done. Are we still talking?